Good morning. The next case on our calendar today is A24-0555, State of Minnesota versus Dylan Stephan Gall. Counsel for appellant is present. The court did receive notice this morning that counsel for respondent will not be appearing here today for oral arguments. Counsel for appellant, do you still wish to proceed with your argument?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay, please. You can proceed when you're ready then.
May it please the court. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant appellate public defender, and I represent Dylan Gall, the appellant in this matter. We're here asking this court to reverse the district court's dispositive pretrial ruling and with it, Gall's conviction. And there are a lot of ways that this court can resolve this case, all of which touch on at least one issue of first impression for Minnesota courts. But I'm going to start by focusing on the most narrow way to do that. Under the district court's analysis, an email is like a letter. And the sender of an email, like the sender of a letter, reasonably expects that that email will arrive at its destination without government interference. And as the state concedes, it was the state's burden to show then that the search in this case happened after the email had landed in the recipient's inbox.
The letter's a little different because it's a different vehicle. And one might presume when you put a letter in the mail that the sender and the recipient are the only two who will have access to it, and there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. But why does your argument fit the circumstances of this case where you have one of the communicators is communicating knowingly by the defendant on an account that is accessible to the school?
So I guess I would take issue with the assertion that it was knowingly accessible by the school. The district court did find that as a former student, he knew or should have known that the accounts were monitored, but there's no evidence in the record that they were informed. There's evidence in the record that they were monitored and that they were informed, that certain uses go against school policy, but never that the students were warned or were notified that the accounts were monitored.
So I'm clear on the record, though, the email address is a school email address.
That's right, Your Honor.
The sender is aware they're sending it to a school email address,
yes,
not
that's
just
right.
A gmail.com.
Yep, that's right. But there is no evidence in the record that either the student or Gall, as a former student, were informed that the emails were not only subject to school board policies, but also monitored to enforce those policies. And so, the district court's finding otherwise was clearly erroneous. But the case law analogizing emails to letters, that's really the minimally protective under the Constitution. And I don't see any reason that it would not apply to this situation, where at the very least, Gall had the expectation that his email would arrive with the recipient. And really the question is whether he has the reasonable expectation of privacy gives rise to standing. Does he have standing to contest this search? And if it happened in transit, he has standing. And the cases say that the sender of a letter reasonably expects that it arrives at its destination. And at that point, maybe if it is like a letter, they don't have standing to contest a search of somebody else's property, somebody else's inbox. But as Judge Ross points out, I don't think emails are like letters. They are more like phone calls, in which case, both sides of that conversation have a reasonable expectation of privacy and standing to challenge a search of those communications.
Well, they're more like phone calls at the time of transit, but after receiving, it's more like a letter. The email sits in one's inbox or in some other archive.
Well, I think it certainly shares characteristics with both phone calls and letters, but I still maintain that it is more like a phone call because you still have, you have a two-way conversation. I was thinking about, you know, maybe
but one it doesn't example. Disappear like the language, right. Like the oral communication and phone call that, unless it's recording at the recorded at the moment of the communication, it's gone. But it's think sort of common knowledge that emails don't work that way.
That's right.
They sit, they exist.
That's right. And in some ways they're sitting in both people's inboxes. And so, you know, one example.
Doesn't that work against your position?
No, I don't think it does. So I was thinking the example of, so we have person A and person B. Law enforcement is trying to get at the email conversations between person A and person B. But they don't have enough, you know, to get a warrant. And so if that analogy holds true, then person A doesn't have standing to challenge a search of person B's email, and person B doesn't have standing to challenge a search of person A's email. So what's to stop law enforcement from searching person B's email without a warrant and using it against person A and vice versa? That way a search has occurred, a warrantless search has occurred in a place where both have reasonable expectations of privacy. You get the same information, but there's no standing to challenge each other's search. And that doesn't make any sense. That's not how emails work. And that is where emails are more like phone calls, where both people have an expectation that that conversation is being protected from government interference.
Counsel, going back to an earlier question as it relates to this being a student email, isn't there testimony in the record that not only is it a student email, but there's a disclaimer saying that this is a school email and that this school email, the contents of this email is governed by the school's policies? Isn't that enough to inform him? Or how does that play into our analysis as to whether or not he has a reasonable expectation of privacy, whether in transit or after received by the school?
Yeah, so I mean, it certainly, it that disclaimer, I agree, that's in the record, but it doesn't say that the emails are monitored to enforce those policies. It just says they are the contents are governed by those policies. And if you don't know what those policies are, and if they involve a monitoring enforcement component, I don't think it does affect your reasonable expectation of privacy such that.
But doesn't it say governed, doesn't it say managed by the Owatonna school? So yes, this is a question of wordplay, whether or not managed mean governed or managed mean monitored. It seems to me that it says that the Owatonna school district, this is our email and our rules tell us how we're going to proceed.
I think I agree with that, but that doesn't say, that doesn't mean that it's monitored. And I think that is an important.
In terms of whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, doesn't the disclaimer factor into that?
I think it probably factors into it. You know, and I think maybe that's how we get into the school search cases. We've got TLO and Earls. And, you know, students do have limited privacy expectations. That's for sure. But that doesn't mean that schools can perform blanket dragnet suspicionless searches. Under those cases, even when you're performing a suspicionless search, like a drug test, there's a balancing test that has to occur. And here, I think the state's in even more trouble than in just the question of whether it, you know, the search occurred while it was in transit or in the student's inbox. Because here there's a showing that needs to be made under TLO and Earls that, you know, that you have to balance the student's privacy rights against the nature, the character of the intrusion. And then you also have to look at the government's interest, the problem that the government means to address, and then the efficacy of that policy in addressing that problem. And the state didn't do that here. They didn't present any witnesses about, you know, the safety issues related to emails. The only thing is, I think it's on page 22, they make some comment about how they have an issue with self-harm. But there's no testimony about whether the monitoring policy is effective at addressing that issue, or you know, and no balancing in terms of the nature of the intrusion, which is significant. It's more than a drug testing policy, which under TLO and Earls they talk about how it doesn't reveal very much information, whereas email is different. It is you know, as the court said in Warshak, it's an account of a person's life. It's medical records, it's love letters, it's can be sexual activity, it can be you know, family finances. I've had my Gmail account for 15 years, and you could probably write a warts and all biography just based on reading those emails. It's a that's a serious intrusion, and so it needs to be balanced against a serious government interest. And
but if I send an email to anyone in the courtroom today, why would I have an expectation of privacy that individual or anyone else would have access to it? Why do I have an expectation of privacy after I've sent it to you?
Yeah, I mean, because it's a communication network, and Warshak said that, you know, that's a paramount concern for the Fourth Amendment is information traveling through communication networks, and that's where it is more like a phone call, where, you know, in CATS we have information being shared.
I guess that gets back to my original conundrum. Why isn't it, at least at that moment, after it's received, more like a letter?
Because it is one part of a two-way conversation. It's not
except that it can be forwarded. So it's different than a phone call in that, you know, a phone call ends when people hang up the phone.
Yeah.
Whereas an email is a written doc or electronic document that could be sent on to someone else.
That's right. And certainly a person sending an email is assuming the risk that a third party could do that. But I think what Maxwell, Mayer, Ackerman, DiTommaso all say is that, you know, the fact that you are assuming the risk that a third person could pass some information on doesn't mean you're giving up your reasonable expectation against government intrusion. I think it's DiTommaso that specifically says the fact that an email is forwarded does not have any impact on the reasonable expectation of privacy analysis. These are all, I mean, email inherently involves third parties, just like phone calls inherently involve third parties. You're assuming the risk, the defendant in CATS assumed the risk that the person they were talking to was recording the phone call and could turn that over to police. That doesn't mean that that law enforcement may simply listen in from the beginning just because a third person is involved.
Isn't this more, I guess, if we're looking for analogies, more like a voicemail than a phone call, an email?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I mean, it is.
But it's it. I mean, it's a communication that occurs as it's being uttered, but then it sits.
I think that's right, but. But it is a two-way conversation. It is like listening into an email conversation. When you, I know that the exhibit with all the emails in it isn't actually part of the record, but just for illustrative purposes, I mean, it's just a constant back and forth. And you don't get just one email. You know, you don't get the one email from Gall saying, good morning. You get the student's response, and then Gall's response, and then the student's response, and then Gall's response. And it's a conversation that you're listening into. And the fact that it's been memorialized, sure, if she forwarded it on to the school, certainly he would have no, you know, no claim that he expected her to keep it private. And because she didn't, or because she didn't respect that expectation, you know, the Fourth Amendment should still protect it. It wouldn't. I think that's pretty clear. But people who are in part of a conversation reasonably expect that the government is not listening in, and that they're not interfering, they're not intercepting that conversation in transit. And whether it's memorialized or sort of ongoing, I think is not really dispositive under the Fourth Amendment analysis. So I see I've got just a little bit of time left. But I think I've hit kind of some of my main points.
Can you address this, the question about the testimony as to whether or not the email, well, I think the district court found that the email had arrived at the server. I'm not
Thank you,
paraphrasing that. And I know you raised a question about that in your brief.
Yeah, I'm very glad you brought that up. So I just want to read from the transcript, because rereading my brief, maybe it wasn't as clear as the transcript is. So this is what happened at the hearing. So this is the defense attorney questioning Mr. Halverson, who is the IT director. The defense attorney says, "And does Bark read the emails prior to the email landing in the student's actual account, or does it do it once the email is physically in the account?" Mr. Halverson says, "That's a good question. I don't know that I've got an answer that I could give you at this time." Defense attorney says, "So it's possible then that Bark is screening each email prior to it actually hitting the student's email drive or account, I should say." Mr. Halverson answers, It's not impossible. I don't know. My answer to that is I don't know." So where the IT director, the only person who is presenting any evidence on this point, says he does not know, you cannot infer from his lack of knowledge either way.
However, counsel, on page 20 and page 21 and 22, in describing the Go Guardian and in describing Bark and describing the Google server, he also talks about it in terms of it only applying to student and employees' email. So can you read that testimony in conjunction with the other testimony to infer that, is that enough for the district court to support the district court's finding? And I'm looking at page 20, lines, I believe 4 to 14, it talks about Bark and the monitoring. It says, now does the school district employ, I'm sorry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
Does the school district employ some type of monitoring system? It says Go Guardian. Then it later talks about, does every external email go through kind of the school district? And I think, paraphrasing part of it, he actually makes a distinction between it monitoring student accounts and teacher accounts, such that it seems to me, could the court take the collective kind of testimony and find that the district court's finding of fact was supported by the whole of the record as it relates to what he's testified to?
No, Your Honor. So I think as far as the testimony in pages 20 and 21 goes, I mean, he's just sort of talking about how Bark and Go Guardian work. I agree that it's student emails and not staff, but they say it screens every email going into or out of a student inbox. And then, but ultimately, you know, when Mr. Halverson is asked to clarify, does he know where the search is happening? He says, "No, I don't know." That's a good question. And when that's the pivotal fact here, and the state had the burden to prove the reasonableness of the search, it needs to be held against the state, just like this court did recently in Foreign-Cam. And I see that my time is up, but we ask this court to reverse the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. For your helpful argument and for the briefing. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.